Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Today is May 2nd, 2018, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues for our weekly Lunch and Learn. United Orthodox Synagogues of Houston, Texas, for our Lunch and Learn. And we are discussing Parshat Emor, which we could find on page 636 in the Chumashim. And we are going to be specifically talking today about the mitzvah. I'm sorry, that's the wrong page I gave you. The parsha starts
672.
Yeah, on 672, but we need to be on page 683. And we are going to be talking about the mitzvah of the Omer offering, and the two loaves that are the Shtei Halechem, the two loaves that are brought on Shavuos. The Omer is brought on Pesach, and the two loaves are brought on Shavuos. And we're going to talk about both of those and the connection to them. Let's just read the Psukim first, which will give us a sense of how the Torah perceives the relationship between these two mitzvot. So, we are on verse number 9, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, on page 682. Daber al b'nei Yisrael v'yamarta aleihem, ki tavo el ha'aretz asher ani noten lachem, u'ktzartem et ketzira, v'veitem et omer reishit ketzirchem el ha'kohen. So this mitzvah is when the Jews enter the land of Israel. You shall bring an omer from your first harvest to the Kohen. V'nif et ha'omer l'tnei Hashem l'rtzonchem macharat ha'shabbat y'nifenu ha'kohen. He shall wave the omer before Hashem to gain favor for you on the morrow of the rest, which is the second day of Pesach. The Kohen shall wave it. V'asitem b'yom ha'nifchem et ha'omer keves tamim ben shnato l'olah l'Hashem. And there's a karban, an offering that comes with it. Uminchato shnei esrim solit b'ulav Hashemen ishel Hashem reach nichoach v'nisko yarn v'yatahin. Its meal offering shall be 2/10 epha of fine flour mixed with oil, a fire offering to Hashem, a satisfying aroma, and its libation shall be wine 1/4 hin. Okay, so that's the essential of the. The essence of the karban, the lechem v'kali v'charmel lo tochlu ad etzam hayom hazeh ad haviyachem et karban elokeichem chukat olam adoratechem b'chol moshratechem. You shall not eat bread or roasted kernels or plum kernels until this very day, until you bring the offering of your God, etc. This is talking about the obligation to not eat of the previous harvest, of the previous planting, until this karban is brought. And once this karban is brought, then that frees up the grain to be used for bread to be produced. Okay, so this is done on the second day of Pesach. It's called the Karban HaOmer. Okay, we also start counting the days between Pesach and Shavuot, which we're going to get to in a minute. Also on the second day of Pesach. Okay, next we have the counting. Usvartem lachem erachat haShabbat miyom aviyachem et omer hatnufa sheva shabbatot tmimot tihiena. You shall count for yourselves from the morrow of the rest, also the second day of Pesach, from the day when you bring the omer, 7 weeks that shall be complete. Ad mimracharat haShabbat haShvit tisperu 50 yom vikravtem mincha chadasha laHashem. Until the morrow of the 7th week, you shall count 50 days, and you shall offer a new meal offering to Hashem. And this is the specific offering. Moshevotechem taviu lechem tenufa shtayim, shnei esrim sola tiyena chametz tiafena bikurim laHashem. And the specific is, from your dwelling place you shall bring bread that shall be waved, 2 loaves made of 2/10 epha. They shall be a fine flour. They shall be baked, leavened, etc. So this is the the three items that we're going to talk about today. We have the Karban HaOmer, which was barley, which was brought on the second day of Pesach. Okay? And then the counting between the days of Pesach and Shavuot, and then the two loaves that had to be brought on Shavuot. Yeah.
Because barley is considered chametz, isn't it? Or is it?
It's only considered chametz if it's cooked.
Oh,
barley
okay.
is just like wheat's not chametz, right?
Okay.
Wheat isn't chametz.
Depends how it's.
We have matzah is made out of wheat flour, right? These things are only chametz if they're prepared and they're allowed to become chametz, right?
So if you have barley that's not chametz, then why are we not allowed? Then why are we not allowed to eat it?
You are. You eat wheat.
Yeah, but barley.
No,
barley's the same as wheat. You just can't make it into chametz.
So
once you cook it, it becomes chametz.
But barley rises when you cook it. Just
right. So
like
does wheat. So barley's one of the things that become chametz. So you could make matzah out of barley if you want.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, these things raw are not chametz. There's no prohibition of owning flour on Pesach.
Well, there is a prohibition. Don't you have
of
to sell your
owning,
chametz?
Yeah, but what makes flour chametz?
Flour is not chametz if it's
until
not cooked.
It hits water.
Correct.
The water.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay.
There's no prohibition of owning those things.
Yeah, but how do you make matzah?
With flour.
Yeah, I know, but you got to use water.
Correct, but we don't let it rise. We don't let it ferment. It doesn't become chametz. That's exactly the point. The fact that something has one of the grains that can become chametz doesn't make it chametz, as we see from matzah.
So we can have a barley matzah.
Yeah.
You can figure out how to do it.
You can figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
your
mission.
yeah, it could be done. Yeah. Okay. So the questions I want to talk about when it comes to these items are, first of all, the notion of the waving. Right? There's a lot of waving going on here. In verse 11, Pasuk Yud Bet, you shall wave the Omer before Hashem to gain favor. And then also there's a waving when it comes to the bread. The bread as well. And I'm going to read a midrash about that. So that's a question about this whole, you know, the waving of these offerings. What's behind that? And we also want to talk about the counting between Pesach and Shavuot. What does that represent? Why do we have a specific obligation to count the days between Pesach and Shavuot? It seems that there's a connection between the two, right? When you count between one day and another day, it seems that there's some sort of connection between the two days. So the question is, what's the connection between Pesach and Shavuot?
Well, Pesach, they left Mitzrayim, and Shavuot, they got the Sefer Torah, so...
Right, so
there's
what's the
connection, right?
What's the connection?
Well, had they not left Mitzrayim, they wouldn't have gotten to the point of getting the Ten Commandments.
Right, and they wouldn't have had Hanukkah or Purim.
Right, okay,
so,
but
we don't
but
count.
You're just talking those
but
two.
I'm saying, why don't we count between those? They're saying, what's the...
Because the other ones aren't connected to the Pesach story or to the leaving Mitzrayim.
Why
Hanukkah is later.
But why is the Torah connected to the story? Only because it happened right then? That's just coincidence.
I don't know. I think it's more than coincidence.
What is it?
I think it's a progression of things that happened.
Okay. So you have to figure out what's the connection. So
yeah,
right now we're seeing that they happen to be close to each other. But what's the thematic connection between them? What does one have to do with the other? Theoretically, we could have gotten the Torah 10 years later.
But they didn't.
So all we're seeing right now is time. Is there anything more than the fact that they're close together? And had they not been, so you're suggesting, had they not been close together, we wouldn't have been counting between them.
Right.
Okay, so all it is right now is a connection of that they happen to be close.
Those two things are connected.
But right now, all we're able to identify is the fact they're connected, but that they are close together. What happens? What if they had been 100 days apart? Would we have counted?
Maybe.
So it's only about the time. So I'm trying to think, is there a thematic connection? Okay. Right now, all we have is they were close together. And then the question we would have to ask is, what's close enough to be considered connected? 49 days, 30 days, 100 days, or is there something else that relates one of these days, Pesach, to Shavuot, or maybe not, or maybe it just happens to be that they were close together. That's what. That's the second question. And the third question is, why is this carbon of the Omer told us in the middle of the holidays? Right? This is a section in the Torah that's talking about the holidays. We have Pesach, Shavuot, and Rosh Hashanah, and Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeret. It seems like the carbon, at least the carbon, yeah, both of these carbonot, maybe should have been in a separate section dealing with carbonot, and they would have told us this is when you bring them. But the details of them break up, it seems, a discussion about the carbonot in general. So what are they doing here? Okay, so those are the sort of three questions. Again, why are we waving? What's the connection between Pesach and Shavuot that they're connected with an obligation to count the days between them? And why is this carbon placed in both of these offerings placed in the middle of the section of the holidays? They break up a discussion of the holidays. Okay, those are the questions. So first, to get to the first question, which is going to lead us to all the answers, right? I want to look at a midrash. Okay, I want to look at a midrash which is from Vayikra, midrash on Vayikra, midrash on our parsha, which talks about the waving of the karbanot. Okay, it is from Midrash Rabbah in Vayikra. Chaf Chet He, 28:5. Okay? And it's quoting the Pasuk, Venif et haomer lifnei Hashem, which is Pasuk Yud Aleph. You shall wave the Omer before Hashem. So what is the waving? I'll read you the question as it's posed by the Netivot Shalom, who we've studied before. The Netivot Shalom is Rabbi Shalom Noach Berusovsky, who was the late Rebbe of the Slonim Hasidim, okay? And he asked the question as follows. He says, Yesh levaer ha'inyan she'omer nikra omer ha'tenufa, the omer of the waving. And the two bread karbanot, right? The first, it was the barley on Pesach. And then after we count the 49 days, which brings us to Shavuot, we have the two breads. Those are also called the bread of waving. And throughout this whole parsha, we have many times the Torah talks about waving. For example, on the day that you bring the Omer of the waving. Another reference to it. It seems that the key to the Omer is that it's the first harvest, and that should be the key, but instead the Torah keeps focusing on the tenufa, on the waving. That's the way the Slonim Rebbe poses the question. And to answer the question, he directs our attention to the Midrash, which says as follows, V'heinif Hashem et ha'omer lefnei Hashem, V'heinif et ha'omer lefnei Hashem, you shall wave the Omer before God. And the Midrash discusses how is this done, right? How is the waving done, right? So we have other waving that we do. When do we wave things?
With the Etrog and the Lulav.
Right, on Sukkot, we wave the Etrog and the Lulav, right?
Oh, death is called waving?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is called waving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the royal way.
I don't understand what's the wave. I have no clue about the korban, okay?
Right. Well, that's
okay, how do you wave the korban?
That's what we're going to talk about. You're holding a measure of barley in your hand, and it says you have to wave it. So what do? It's in some sort of basket or in your hand, and so what do you do?
Wave it.
Right? So what do you do?
Yeah, but so
he says as follows. Rabbi Chama bar Rabbi Ukva, B'shem Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina Amar, Molich Umevi. Rabbi Chama bar Ukva said in the name of Rabbi Chana, he extends it outward and brings it inward. Like this and like this. Okay? That's the waving. That's the hanafa.
The ball.
Right?
That's the
right. The wave. Okay? Mole umorid. And you go like this. Right? So you go out.
Just like a sukkah. Just like
right? A man. Out and back.
Just like a lulav.
Up
just
and
like
the only lulav is we also. The lulav, shake and wave, that's just semantics.
Oh,
right? Really? That's just semantics. You go, you lulav, you go like this with the lulav, and you ring it back with the lulav, and you go up with the lulav, you go down with the lulav, right? So you could call it waving, you can call it shaking, but it's similar, it's a similar thing, okay? Although there are some, maybe there are some differences, but... that's the question. We're going to get there. Yeah, yeah.
It says you shall bring an omer from your first harvest. Could it not be a stalk of barley? As opposed to a measure? I mean, it doesn't say anything with the measure.
Yeah, I think it does. It does.
It says
on the day
flour.
You wave the omer, you shall perform it's meal or... I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm not sure
maybe
exactly.
The waving of the omer is like you would wave the lulav.
I'm not sure exactly. That's a good question. That's a good question.
Well, like it says fine flour. Doesn't say
okay.
Wheat.
So, so let's keep going. So we have the waving, right? Now on Sukkot, of course, we also go to the right and the left, right? So we'll go up and down, right and left, backwards and forwards, right? Here, right now, we're saying we go out and in and up
and down.
And down. So then the Midrash goes on to talk about the symbolism, right? What does this mean, right? So the Midrash says, Molichu mevi, Lemi Shahaolam Kulo Shelo. He extended outward and brings it inward for the sake of the one whom the entire world belongs. Meaning it's a symbol that we have to ask why this symbol is important. Right? It's a symbol that we're declaring, right, by doing this and this, that the whole world belongs to God. Okay? So the question is, but why? Right, why is that symbol important now? Why don't we do that with every sacrifice? Why are we doing it now?
You do it only in the Omer, or you do it in Pesach also?
This Omer is on Pesach. Yeah, it's on the second day of Pesach. Right.
Giving and taking.
Okay. So why do we? In the giving and the taking
God
do we want to?
Gives and he. Takes
exactly.
Away.
Meaning this is the first harvest. So we want to indicate that we recognize God's role in our successful harvest, right? It's
the harvest, not the first harvest goes to Shavuot.
This is the barley harvest. This is the barley. This is the barley harvest, not the wheat harvest. And then we're going to talk about the wheat harvest. But this is the barley harvest and the bread, similar, right? So we are showing good clarification, right? We are showing that. It's all, you know, and by going up, by going out and back and up and down, right? We're showing that this is all thanks to God. The Midrash says, "Male umorid lemishel yonim v'hatachtonim shelo." We also raise it and lower it to show to whom the upper and lower belongs to. So, meaning we have these different directions to symbolize that this is all God's stuff, and that yes, we played a role by farming it and harvesting it and planting it, etc., and all that hard work is important. And we also recognize God's hand. We all recognize God's hand in that. So, with that in mind, I want to read with you something really fascinating that the Slonim Rebbe says. Now that we understand the symbolism of the waving, he says as follows. He says, Sha'omer karav me'si'orim. The omer on Pesach is a barley offering. Shehem ma'achal behema. Right?
We don't eat in Pesach barley. Right?
We're not talking about anything that we eat. This is an offering that was brought. We're not talking about eating. We're talking about an offering that was brought and barley. We talked about that before. We're not talking about chametz here. We're just talking about barley that was brought as a omer, and it was given to the Kohen, and the Kohen waved it. Okay? So, what is the Se'orim? The Se'orim is an animal food. At least it was in the time of the Torah. She'omer kerav mis'orim she'hem machal behema. That's what we did on Pesach. Ushtei ha'lechem, the two loaves that we're going to bring after we count the 49 days, makrivim mechitim. Those were made out of wheat. Shehe machal adam. That's human food. Okay? So, now we maybe could start putting all the pieces together. We have a offering of barley, which is brought on Shavuot, which represents an animal food. And we have an offering of wheat in the form of bread. It's not only wheat, it's also bread, which represents human ingenuity, right? The barley is raw as it's fed to an animal. The bread is baked from out of wheat, which is human food, and it's baked, which requires human, right? We have to figure, human beings have to figure out how to make bread, and we have to make bread, so it's ingenuity, it's creativity, it's human action, right? But we connect those two by counting between the two karbanot, right? So we have a raw, undeveloped animal food on Pesach and a developed, cultivated human food on Shavuot, and we count the days between them, which connects them. So with that information, can we see a connection between Pesach and Shavuot, or some sort of relationship, even not a connection, a relationship or a progression between Pesach and Shavuot?
Of course you see it.
What is it?
That's my question.
Well, I asked first.
You see it because you mention it together.
All right, so what does it mean, though? What does it mean?
That even if it's food for animals, it's still God thinks that he prepared it.
Good, excellent.
And the same when you go to the people's food.
Right, human food, right?
You waited for 7 weeks for it.
Right.
It's God think, but why did you have to wait 7 weeks?
Well, that happens to be when it ripens. That happens to be when we're ready for it. But the question is, why are we counting between the days? Right? But the counting, as we said,
till the is ready to
connects.
You said till it's ready to be used.
Yeah. So, but why are we counting, though? Why we have to... The counting creates a connection between
it
the
keeps
two.
People,
but why?
It keeps people's mind on what's going to happen. Or what they're supposed to do.
Right, okay.
It's leading them to...
Okay, right. So there's definitely a progression here, as Sandra Morgan writes on Facebook. There's a progression here. And I'll read you what the Slonim Rebbe says. This is very interesting. Because we often think of Pesach as the ultimate. And Shavuos is like the stepchild of all the Chagim, right? Uh-huh. Sukkot is a big deal, and Pesach is a big deal. Shavuot... It's only one day, or in Chutz La'aretz, it's 2 days. There's no ritual. There's no ritual connected to Shavuot.
Oh, sure.
Right? That's all made up later, probably because of a lack of Torah ritual.
Because
on Sukkot,
it's a very important holiday.
Right, right.
That's when God gave you the
but there's still no exactly. So, but
you
on Sukkot.
But there's no ritual, and it took all that
time. Right, so let's go. Exactly, Marilyn. So here we go. There's no mitzvot.
There's
no mitzvot connected to Shavuot. On Sukkot, there's a mitzvah of lulav and etrog and sukkah. On Pesach, there's a mitzvah of matzah and prohibitions against chametz and the obligation of Sippur, you'd see at Mitzrayim, of telling the story.
Right.
On Shavuot, there are no... On Shavuot... There are no mitzvot specific to Shavuot. So what's going on? So here comes the Slonim Rebbe, and he says something very interesting. He says, we now could go back and talk about the waving. We could explain the reason for the waving based on the Midrash, that we're making a progression, he says, from Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is essentially obviously very important, so we could attain our freedom, but that's not the end of the story. Right? I don't want to talk about what the end of the story is, but certainly Yetziat Mitzrayim is not the end of the story. Because what happens at 49 days after Yetziat Mitzrayim? Kabbalat HaTorah. So we're counting from Yetziat Mitzrayim to the getting of the Torah, and what he says is, it's like the connection is to recognize that we're progressing from one level, the low level of the Seorim, of the animal food, all the way up to Har Sinai, to the Torah, to people food. Now, we shouldn't downplay the importance of Yetziat Mitzrayim, right? But Yetziat Mitzrayim is not complete. In fact, the Ramban says this in his introduction to the book of Shemot, right? When he's writing his introduction to the book of Shemot, he writes as follows: Hakatuv Sefer Bereshit Hu Sefer HaYetzirah B'Chidush HaOlam. The book of Genesis is the book of creation. V'Yetzirat Kol Notzer, and the book of every created being. U'B'Mikrei HaAvot Kulam Shem Ki'inyan Yetzirah LaZaram. And it's also a discussion about the Avot, the patriarchs, who are the creation of Am Yisrael, if you will, right? B'vnei shekol mikrehem tziyurei divarim l'rmoz l'hodia kol atid lavo lahem. All the events that happened to them were symbolic occurrences, etc. And then he talks about Sefer Shemot. He says, Sefer ve'ele Shemot b'inyan hagalut harishona hanigzar b'feirush. The book of Shemot, which is about the first exile, which was explicitly decreed, and the redemption from it, this is why the beginning of the book of Shemot again reverts back with the names of the peoples who went down to Mitzrayim, even though they were mentioned at the end of Sefer Bereshit. They're going down is the beginning, right, when the brothers of Yosef finally went down, the whole family, that's the beginning of the exile. And then he says, what's the end of the story, says the Ramban? The exile was not completed until the day that they returned to their place.
Back to Israel.
Right. The El Ma'alat Avotam Yashuvu, and to the exalted status of their fathers. Ukishi Yatsumi Mitzrayim, here's the key. When they left Mitzrayim, Afal Pishi Yatsumi Beit Avadim, even though they left slavery, which is very important, Adayin Yachshavu Golim. They're still exiles. Why? Ki Hayu Be'eretz Lo Lahem, Nivuchim Bamidbar. They were walking around in a foreign place, in the desert. They were walking around in circles in the desert. They were stuck. Ukishabou el Har Sinai, ve'asu ha-mishkan, v'shav ha-kadosh baruch hu v'hishresh chinato b'neihem. But when they got to Sinai, got the Torah, and built the mishkan, and God's presence rested on them, az shavu el ma'alat avotam. That's when they reestablished or reacquired the status of their forefathers, Shehaya Sod Eloka Alei Ohaleihem, which was the presence of God, the counsel of God on their tents, Vehem Heim HaMerkava V'az Nechshavu Gulim, and that is when they were finally considered to be redeemed. V'lachein Nishlam HaSefer Hazeh Pashlimo Inyan HaMishkan Uviyot Kivod Hashem Malei Oto Tamid. That is why he says this book, the second book of the Torah, Shemot, concludes with the completion of the building of the Mishkan and God's glory filling it. So he says it explicitly, what the Slonim Rebbe says it's being alluded to in this whole progression. The reason, so therefore that also answers the question of why it belongs in the Parshiot, right? Why is this discussion of these two sacrifices, the Omer on Shavuot, on Pesach, and the Shtei HaLechem on Shavuot. What is that doing in the middle of a section dealing with Chagim? It should be in a section of the Karbanot. But the reason it is because that's part of the progression. That's part of the Chag. Meaning, the way the Slonim Rebbe puts it is, it's almost like we have a 49-day Chol HaMoed.
Right, yeah.
Right, we have Pesach, then a Chol HaMoed. What's Chol HaMoed? It gears us up for the second half of the holiday.
Right.
So after Pesach, we have this 49-day period where we're supposed to be gearing ourselves up and spiritually preparing ourselves in order for us to get to Shavuot, which is the acceptance of the Torah at Har Sinai. So it's not only that it happened so close to each other. Really, what he's saying, what the Ramban is saying, is that Shavuot is really the culmination of Pesach. Pesach doesn't end. Because if Pesach would have ended with us laying around in the desert, we would have said Dayenu, as we talked about, because it's still good that God took us out. But that wasn't the goal. The goal was two things, actually, the Ramban says. The Torah and, in his language, his specific language, get back to the place, which no doubt is talking about Eretz Yisrael. He says, Shuvam el Mikomam, which that didn't happen even until later, so that you could really argue that Pesach isn't completed until the Sefer Yehoshua, when Bnei Yisrael step over the Jordan River.
Yeah. Can I play devil's advocate? So sure. How do you explain the golden calf in between?
It was a setback.
It was a setback.
Yeah, it was.
So I'm
yeah.
just saying this is it. You know, they were counting. You were counting, but yet
there was
you
a
weren't
setback.
Quite sure what was going to happen.
It was a setback. Sure. Yeah, for sure. There's no guarantee.
It's like the stock market.
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. Meaning, you're right. We shouldn't look at it as
we want to come out.
Right. It was like this. You're right. It was like this. Correct. Exactly. Right. Perfect. So that answers all the questions. Why barley and why wheat? The waving represents our ability to move in the direction of recognizing that it's all from that we have to put God into this picture. Now, there's one other thing though that we have to do from a modern perspective, right? As I was reading this and reading the Slonim Rebbe, and I remembered the Ramban, it also got me thinking about Israel, right? Modern day Israel. Right, because the Ramban says the Pesach is over, really, culminates when the Jews get to Israel. So the question, is that true? Is that true? Is the goal just to get to Israel? Right? Or is there more towards...
to establish a Jewish state.
Is that it? Is that the goal?
No,
what's
no,
the
no.
purpose?
And bring all the Jews.
So I want to share with you... I want to share with you a few things about on this score, which are very interesting. Meaning, there are one way to look at the state of Israel we'll call it the Pesach way. Pesach is about no longer being under someone else's thumb and being safe. Right? So there's one way that's one way you can look at Israel, right? Israel is about no longer being under someone's thumb and being safe, right? That Israel, the state of Israel has achieved its goal by being a safe haven. That's it. Right? We should not downplay that. That is crucially important. That's something the Jewish people did not have for thousands of years, right? So the state of Israel is a safe haven. And period, whatever else happens doesn't really matter. The state of Israel was established and has achieved its raison d'etre, right? Its purpose in life, because Jews now have a place to go when they feel persecuted. It's a safe haven. Okay, that may not be the only way to look at the state of Israel. There may be other aspects of the importance of the state of Israel, which are crucial to consider. So I'll share some of them with you from the writing of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and then I'll share some others with you that I've been thinking about on my own. So Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote this book called, he didn't write this book. He gave five addresses, five drashot, at the yearly meetings of the Mizrahi movement between 1962 and 1967. Okay? First, it was published in Yiddish as four, and then it was five, then it was published in Hebrew as Chamesh Drashot, and it was finally published in English as The Rav Speaks, five addresses on Israel history and the Jewish people. And in one of these essays, Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about a number of ways in which the state of Israel is important besides being a safe haven, okay? Which are very important. So first of all, one is the state of Israel allows the Jewish people for the first time, I would say, not the first time ever, but certainly the first time where they're able to do it unimpeded, to fulfill the mitzvah of living in Israel, right? Without anyone else being in charge, without stopping you. Meaning, if I wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel in the Middle Ages, or during the when the British Ottoman Empire was in charge, or the British Empire, someone was at the gate saying, either you can or you can't come in. Right now, with Medinat Yisrael, there's no one at the gate. They're saying, come on, right? Correct. Because it's a mitzvah. We're talking about the mitzvah perspective, right? If you want to fulfill the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel, and now as you're a Jewish person, you want to fulfill that mitzvah, this is the first time in 2,000 years where you could do that unimpeded, right? And also, right, that's one. Two, he says, that the establishment of the state of Israel, and this I want to read because it's very, very interesting. He says, he's talking about the establishment of the state of Israel and the positive effect it has had on Torah. He talks about the Mizrahi movement, which was founded in 1901 or 1902 in this lecture. And he says, I would like to ask a simple question. What would the yeshivot and Torah scholars rescued from the Holocaust, these burning embers taken from the fire, have done if the Joseph of 5662, meaning he's referring to the Jews of 1901, 1902, had not trod a path for them in the land of Israel and had not made possible the transplanting of the tree of life of Lithuania and other lands in the Holy Land. Meaning Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, had the Jews, and he's crediting Mizrahi for the religious part of it, not started opening up the land of Israel much earlier, right, which led to the establishment of the state of Israel, what would have happened after the Holocaust? Where would all these yeshivot have gone? Where would all these people have gone? And in fact, Rav Lichtenstein, in a beautiful essay on the 50th anniversary of the State of Israel, says something similar. He says, as a student of the Beit Midrash, if we compare the state of the Torah world today with its condition at the time the state was established, we will find that we have good reason for excitement, praise, and thanks. Let us not forget that the number of students enrolled in Yeshivat Haratzion, which he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Gush Etzion, alone equals the number of yeshiva students that Ben-Gurion was asked to exempt from military service at that time, a mere 50 years ago. I am no historian, but I doubt very much that at any stage in Jewish history, the number of students in Batei Midrash was ever higher than the number today. This is interesting. Saying if you take all of the yeshivot in Europe, we talk about all the Torah history of Europe, Valazhin, and that yeshiva, and this yeshiva, Rabbi Lichtenstein is saying that if you put all them together, it doesn't even come close to the number of people studying Torah in Israel today. With all the criticism and with the occasional irritation, both religious and cultural, that accompanies this phenomenon, let us not take for granted that which has been achieved in the sphere of pure Torah. A simple indicator, look at the number of Sifrei Kodesh, Jewish books, being sold today, and even more importantly, the number being studied. So that's another thing Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Lichtenstein point to, meaning the established state of Israel really saved, in many ways, the world of Torah. And if it didn't save it, it certainly increased it, and the type of Torah and the level of Torah that's coming out of Israel is really unmatched anywhere else in the world. A third point Rabbi Soloveitchik makes, and this is, to me, really fascinating. Third, the state of Israel can benefit not only the study of Torah, but its application as well. For within the state, it is possible to apply halakha to a broad range of issues, including modern technology and public life. Meaning, until the state of Israel was established, halakha was only applied to Shabbat and Kashrut, purely ritual matters. When you were living in Tsarist Russia, the Jewish view of government didn't matter because you were not in charge of the government. So you could not create a society based on Jewish ideas and ideals about how a government, how the poor should be taken care of, what a police force should do, what an army should look like, what social services should look like, what, right? All these areas are talked about in halakha, but they were dead for all those years. They were dormant for all those years until the state of Israel came around, right? He said, this is interesting, Rabbi Soloveitchik notes something fascinating in this Chamesh Drashot. He says, on this score, the Charedim and the Reform movement are two sides of the same coin. Both of them believe that Torah has nothing to say to modernity.
Wow.
Right? Has nothing to say to modernity, in Rabbi Lichtenstein's words, meaning that in Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying that the Reform movement, I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily true, but he's saying that the Reform movement rejects any application of Torah into everyday life, right? It doesn't. Everyday life is one thing, one sphere, and Torah is another sphere. I'm not suggesting that that is necessarily a fair read by Rabbi Soloveitchik's perspective, but that's what he says. He said that's also what the Charedim say. Rabbi Soloveitchik says is that we can't apply Torah to modern situations. We have to reject modernity and assume that the Torah cannot apply to it, cannot speak to it, and we have to leave Torah in one sphere and reject modernity in another sphere. Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, no, there is no area of life at all to which halakha cannot address and deal with successfully without rejecting it out of hand. And so that's a third piece that Rabbi Soloveitchik says came about by the establishment of the State of Israel. We could add to those, right, that again, besides
that's
being...
really nice.
Right, besides being...
that's really nice, this point.
Right, and all, but there's more.
Go ahead. Because now it's coming to the ger, how would you... There is a ger toshav and a ger tzedek.
Right.
Now, how would you apply it in your...
Right.
Documentation.
Right.
Passport says
right.
Israeli. It doesn't say Yehudi.
Right. I mean, the example right now are all the asylum seekers who are coming to Israel, right? How do you do that? How do you apply Jewish law and Jewish values to this question, right? And there's more, though, right, which Rabbi Soloveitchik does not talk about, because he's talking about, I think, from a purely religious perspective. But Jewish culture has thrived in Israel in ways where it didn't before. Now, it's true in Europe, in the big cities in Europe, there were Yiddish newspapers and there was Yiddish theater and there was Yiddish literature. But just like Rav Lichtenstein said, you can't compare the amount of people studying Torah in Europe to the amount of people studying Torah in Israel. I don't think you could compare literature, art, music, right? Jewish art, Jewish music, Jewish literature simply would not exist the way it does today. The ability for Jews to express themselves Jewishly would simply not exist today, certainly not the same way it exists today, right? If not for the establishment of the State of Israel that allows Jews, you know, to do these things. And of course, Google wouldn't exist today, which is just the...
imagine that.
That's the, right? That's the worst, right? All these technologies,
the
but in all seriousness,
just to figure out
right?
How,
all the music and all the art and all the creativity that has come out of the State of Israel in the last 70 years certainly wouldn't be the same. So what got me thinking about that is when you have the Ramban and the other sources that we saw today saying that this is all a progression. We went from Yetziat Mitzrayim to Har Sinai to the Mishkan to getting into Eretz Yisrael, and then we were out of Eretz Yisrael, and then we got Eretz Yisrael again. But just getting Eretz Yisrael on its own it should not be the way we look at it. It's just not being there. It's flourishing. It's flourishing there, right? It's an ability to make something out of that safe haven, not just getting to Eretz Yisrael.
There's a quote by David Ben-Gurion. I can't think of the exact quote, but he basically said it in 1968, I think, that until other things happen, Israel is still not redeemed.
Right.
They're still longing for the flesh pots of Egypt.
I know. It rings a bell, too. Right. And that's, by the way, that's an interesting debate that still goes on in Israel today, right, in terms of is there any there are people who really attach a lot of messianic significance to the establishment of the State of Israel, and others who and say that's why it's worthy of celebration, because it's the beginning of the messianic redemption. And other people, Rabbi Soloveitchik, as far as I know, does not talk about messianic Zionism at all. He's looking at it from the three perspectives that I showed you and the other perspectives, that there are many other very valid religious reasons to celebrate the establishment of the State of Israel, the three that Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned, and he mentions others as well in his essays. Those are religiously significant as well, even if you leave the Mashiach out of the picture entirely. And so, again, the connection is we see we count from Pesach to Shavuot to remind ourselves that Pesach is not really successfully completed until we got the Torah and Shavuot. But the Ramban says there's another stage, which is getting to Eretz Yisrael. And then we would add, there's not just getting to Eretz Yisrael, there's what we make of Eretz Yisrael, which is really the key, or the maybe the end of the story. Although ultimately Mashiach is the end of the story. But until that happens, and maybe it's not going to happen until we make the most out of what we have. Okay, have a wonderful day.